Okay, call to order the House Committee on Business and Labor. Call to order the House Committee on Business and Labor for the 5th of February, 2014. Thank you very much. It's so nice to see all of your faces so early this morning. We have a few people late. They're stuck on 217, traffic accident, so, but we'll get going.
217 or 212?
212.
Yeah.
217 is always a mess. Okay, so I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 4104. Jan, if you could summarize the bill, please.
I will. Madam Chair, committee members, this is a measure that expands the interim medical benefits for a subject worker in response to an initial claim for a work-related injury or an occupational disease to include other services that are payable according to terms, conditions, and benefits of the health plan. You have before you a dash one amendment, and it replaces the original measure. It requires a health benefit plan when a workers' compensation claim has not been accepted or denied to expedite the pre-authorization and to guarantee payment of the expenses for medical services. It requires the workers' compensation insurer, the self-insured employer, to pay for the medical services provided, including reimbursement to the injured worker or the health plan. Requires a health benefit plan to pay for medical services if the claim is denied. It specifies that the health benefit plan may not exclude and shall expedite the pre-authorizations if the injured worker is covered both by a workers' comp insurance plan and a health benefit plan. Requires a health benefit plan to guarantee payment of the pre-authorized medical services according to the terms and conditions of the plan. And that is it.
Okay, thank you. Okay, the first person to call up is Representative Holdy. Welcome, Representative Holdy.
Good morning. Madam Chair, committee members, thank you very much for this opportunity to introduce this bill proposal. For the record, my name is Paul Holby, House District 8. So I had to think about it for a second. I wanted to bring you this bill. It actually was a committee bill introduced by the Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency Committee. We were looking at some consumer issues around workers actually getting the benefits that they pay for. And this is, from my perspective, a cleanup bill from 2001. Though probably a few think I've been around that long, or I haven't. I've only been here for 10 years. But this bill in 2001 was originally a Senate bill that Senator Durfler tried to push through and did get through, and it involves the interim medical benefits that are payable or workers should have access to before the workers' comp claim is denied or accepted. The bill proposal that you have in front of you, many have told me, would actually restore the policy intentions of that Senate bill, and Jan could tell me what that is. It's Senate Bill 485 from 2001. The issue here is essentially that when a worker has a health benefit planned and also makes a workers' comp claim, that they should be covered. Either they're covered under workers' comp or they should be covered under their medical plan for the benefits that they provide. So what happens often in this scenario under the current law is that the workers' comp claim is not accepted or it goes on and the health benefit plan does not pay benefits because they consider it a work-related injury. And at some point in the future, oftentimes the worker then, through the workers' comp system, does not get accepted, and sometime in the future, they actually have lost some of their health benefits. benefit sometimes, and then they don't get any coverage at all, when in fact they should have been covered. I think everybody agrees that when you have both the health benefit plan and a workers' comp coverage and a claim, the worker should get have access to the benefits, and the claim should be paid by somebody. And so we have a system where the workers' comp division has pre-existing conditions, and they go back and forth trying to determine who should pay how much. And the insurance industry sort of does the same thing. And so it seems like they should be able to figure out how to expedite these interim medical benefits so the worker can at least get this treatment that they deserve. And the other aspect of this, and in 2001, it was put on the record that besides making sure that the worker does get these benefits and the treatment during this time period, is that there's an assurance that the providers get full payment. And in today's world, as you may know, workers sometimes are so afraid of not being able to get an acceptance on a workers' comp claim that they oftentimes, when it should be a workers' comp claim, will not report it as a work-related injury and just go to their health benefit plan, which probably puts an undue burden on some of our health benefit plans paying things that maybe should be covered under the workers' comp carrier. So in addition to that, because the providers very often have no faith that they're actually going to get paid for these benefits, they will steer away and not even accept worker comp claims. And so we have a system that was set up in 2001 that was supposed to make sure the worker got the treatment they needed, get back to work, you know, cost the system less money, and a system that made sure the providers had assurance that they were going to get paid. And the system is partially broken because of this element. And we had testimony in the interim from some workers who had gone through this sort of a scenario. And it, unfortunately, is more common than we all like to admit. The original bill was fairly simple, and it just basically provided the and made sure that the health benefit plan would pick up when the workers' comp did not or was denied in this time period, a specific time period. But as we got into it, you know, once you do something in workers' comp, it's like there's all sorts of spaghetti intertwined, and you have to fix something over here and over there. So I really appreciate SAFE coming forward with an amendment proposal, which is the -1 amendment that you probably have in front of you. It looks like we're going to need another amendment to fine-tune this a little bit more as we're, you know, uncovering the impacts of changing one statute, how that's going to impact a few others. And I really hope that up next you can hear from the Workers' Comp Division to really answer some of those specific questions. But the real basis of this and what this bill is about is to make sure the worker and the providers basically get the benefits so the worker and the employers are paying for, and that the providers get paid for the services they provide, and these workers get back to work as soon as they can, and that we have some sort of acceptance that the workers' comp claims are a good place for providers to send the appropriate claims instead of them avoiding workers' comp claims and the workers avoiding worker comp reporting at workers' comp, because they actually get, you know, some benefits through the workers' comp claims that they don't in their health benefit plan. But because of the fear of denials and the fear of not getting coverage and not getting treatment and the providers not getting paid, they all walk away from the workers' comp system and go to the health benefit plans for claims that actually should be worker comp claims. So I'm sure you're going to hear from a host of others behind me. I could try to answer some questions, but that's the basic principle behind this bill, and I think the division is prepared to come up and kind of walk through a couple technical pieces of it.
Okay, thank you. Do you have any questions for Representative Holby? Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, who do we want next? John, Laura, okay. Jennifer.
Okay, next we could have John Schultz, Laura Kelly, and Jennifer Flood. Please.
Thank you. I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator for the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. I'm here to provide information about what we term interim medical benefits under the workers' compensation system and this bill, which would make amendments to the law. A little bit of additional history, and I thought that Representative Holby did a good job with this. These benefits were created in 2001 as part of Senate Bill 485, which was a negotiated package of reforms to the workers' compensation system. In addition to a lot of other issues that were covered in that bill, the bill included these type of interim medical benefits. As the representative explained, the intention was to ensure that medical providers would get paid for some of the injured workers' care prior to the acceptance of the claim. This, in turn, would help workers get more prompt care, resulting in better medical and claim outcomes. At that time, the claim determination time period in workers' compensation was 90 days. That same bill reduced it to 60 days, so a workers' compensation insurer or self-insured employer has 60 days to make a decision to accept or deny the claim. The majority of claims are decided in a much shorter time frame than that, but sometimes claims do take that long, and occasionally there are claims that go beyond 60 days for a decision. It's during that period where the worker doesn't know whether their claim is accepted by the workers' compensation insurer that the original bill tried to address, to provide some assurance to both workers and providers that the services would be covered. Interim medical benefits are covered in ORS 656-247, and under this, I think just speak to the Dash 1 amended bill this morning. Under the amended bill, it's similar to the original bill. If the workers' compensation claim is accepted by the workers' compensation insurer or the self-insured employer, they are going to pay for the medical services related to the accepted claim. If the claim is denied by the workers' compensation insurer and the worker has a health benefit plan, then the health benefit plan is responsible to be the payer of the medical expenses according to the terms, benefits, and conditions of their plan. After the claim is denied, medical providers could just directly bill the health insurer, who again, should pay according to their policy. The HB 4104 with the Dash 1 amendments would basically guarantee payment to the healthcare provider for interim medical benefits, again, that are provided within the health benefit plan policy prior to acceptance or denial of the claim. So it guarantees a payment to the provider. The bill would also provide that the health benefit plan would need to expedite pre-authorizations and guarantee payment of expenses for medical services provided prior to acceptance and denial of the claim. We have heard that there are some questions about what does expedited mean, and I think that's the kind of thing that an administrative rules process, which is a public process, can flesh out. The Management Labor Advisory Committee has not yet provided a recommendation on this bill. They did hear from Representative Holby on the bill. They're scheduled to meet on Friday morning to consider the bill and try to give you a recommendation. I do understand that there's potentially other amendments to the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions now or after my colleagues present, as you decide.
Okay. Do you have any questions of Mr. Schultz? Representative Freeman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you kind of got into the talk about the expedited process and administrative rule. Those two things are a little scary in light of some of the other health care issues going wrong in Oregon right now. So I'm just curious how you see that happening. You say it's a public process, which I know administrative rule is supposed to be a public process. Is there any, do you have anything in your kind of thought process on what that means to expedite a process?
Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, when I was talking about expediting the pre-authorization mm-hmm. process for the health provider and the worker, discussion about a administrative rules process basically just goes to the idea that if the legislature does not want to define exactly what expedited means, we would typically do that as part of our administrative role in the workers' compensation system. And so we typically form an external advisory committee of stakeholders to the system that would provide us advice and input on a rule. We typically come to consensus on most of those rules. We then develop the actual rule itself and hold a public hearing and take testimony on the rule before finally deciding to do a final rule or not in the form of that final rule. As an example, in workers' compensation, we have an elective surgery process that by rule that it has to be resolved within a 7-day period between the physician, the insurance company, in terms of answers, at least the initial answers about authorization to provide benefits for the elective surgery. So something such as that, I think, would probably be the process.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions? Okay, next.
Good morning. Chair Doherty, members of the committee. I'm Jennifer Flood. I'm the Ombudsman for Injured Workers with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Our Ombudsman's Office handles approximately 8,000 inquiries from injured workers annually. Today I'd like to share with you, done a good job regarding how this current statute is working here, but I'd like to share with you what we hear from actual injured workers regarding medical treatment prior to acceptance or denial of a workers' compensation claim. We have the task of explaining the workers' comp system to injured workers and helping them through the process, making sure that they're getting the benefits that they're entitled to. But workers get very frustrated when they're injured and they cannot receive medical treatment. It's especially difficult to explain to them why there's a delay in the treatment when they have health insurance plan that would back them up if their workers' compensation claim was ultimately denied. As mentioned before, the workers' comp insurer is not required to pay until the claim is accepted. Most health benefit plans won't start their pre-authorization processes until the actual workers' compensation claim is denied. The medical provider is hesitant on providing treatment without some assurance that they would ultimately be paid for the services that they're providing. The injured worker's treatment is on hold. There's the delay in the treatment, the delay in recovery, delay in getting back to work, and at times there is the loss of their health benefit plan pending that review. Some employers won't continue on with the health insurance plans, okay? Some employers will. But there does come a time where that stops. If the claim has not been accepted or denied by the time their insurance falls off, then they're left with no surgery and nobody to pay for it. I'm going to give you a brief example. Worker injures their shoulder. They believe that it's work-related. They go to the doctor. They're able to currently get diagnostic because that's covered in the statute that the amendment is on. The MRI comes back and says there's a rotator cuff tear, and surgery is needed to enable the worker to return to work. Then everything stops. Because the claim hasn't been accepted or denied, they're not able to proceed with that surgery. My understanding of House Bill 4104 is that that delay would hopefully be removed. The provider would be provided assurance that there would be payment. My understanding is that that payment wouldn't be until after the decision is made, but at least the provider would know that ultimately somebody is going to pay this bill. The worker is able to get their services, not just the diagnostic, but the treatment. They are able to get back to work quicker, they recover quicker, and people are a little bit more happy with that. So I'd be happy to answer any questions as well.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions of Ms. Flood? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Doherty. Members of the committee, my name is Laura Kelly. I'm the insurance commissioner, also with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I'm going to address a couple of items related to the coordination between workers' compensation and health benefit plans. And hopefully I can address some of the questions that came up during the prior discussion of this during the interim session. But I'm also happy to answer any specific questions. So I'm going to cover three main points. One is consumer complaints and how we handle them. Talk a little bit about some of the existing exclusions in health benefit plans relating to workers' compensation or work-related injuries, and any concerns that we elements of the bill that we saw that might warrant some further discussion. So first, with respect to consumer complaints, we've looked back through our complaint logs, and since 2008, we've received about 160 complaints related to workers' compensation insurance generally. I think that probably sounds fairly low, given that, you know, Jennifer is an ombudsman specifically targeted on injured workers. We also have an ombudsman who works with small employers, so often the complaints go through those channels. Even when we receive a complaint, it's fairly typical for us to refer those complaints either to Jennifer or to her colleague who works with small employers, depending on the nature of the issue. Most of the complaints that we would handle within the insurance division have to do with audit procedures, so it really relates to the insurance companies that pay for these benefits. So moving then into how health benefit plan language is structured, there are a number of different ways in which health benefit plans exclude coverage for work-related injuries. It's pretty typical for small group and individual plans to have such exclusions, and they currently do this in a number of different ways. So there may be a blanket exclusion of any work-related injury or illness, even if it's not covered by the workers' compensation system. So it may be fairly broad, and the only way that might actually that exclusion might not exist is if the person who's insured under that policy wasn't able to access the workers' compensation law or the federal equivalent. Sometimes there are just a total exclusion for anything related specifically to workers' comp, not just a work-related injury, but specific to a coverage that was provided under the employer's workers' comp policy. There might be some more expensive, detailed exclusions relating to third-party liability, which would also include workers' compensation. And I have some really detailed language. I won't bore you with all of the details, but I can share examples if anyone is interested. But it's a pretty common practice, and we see that this is done really to preserve the right for workers to seek benefits through the workers' compensation program and not kind of confuse where that payment is coming from. Initially, in the first version of the bill, we had a number of questions in terms of how the coordination would work with pre-authorization under health benefit plans and the structure of benefits under workers' compensation policies. We think that the Dash 1 amendments have resolved those concerns more or less, and we know there's still some work to be done on that, but we think that that's that is significantly resolved. One thing we had discussed was whether or not there might be use in having a disclosure so that people kind of understand how this works, understand kind of what the pre-authorization process might look like versus kind of filing a claim through the workers' comp system. There still could be some consumer confusion in terms of how they're accessing benefits. And the other thing, there are kind of a few technical things within the amendments that we're still looking at, but one relates to a clause at the very end that states that ORS 743A.001 does not apply to this section. And so we're looking at that, just we're trying to understand what the purpose of that is and if that's something that we can provide some more feedback on of what that accomplishes. And the second kind of technical concern that I would raise is it looks like there are some requirements that are specific to PEB also. And technically, PEB is exempt from the insurance code. And so we've seen this come up in some other areas where PEB is included in a bill that inserts language into the insurance code, but we don't technically have regulatory authority, so it can create some confusion, and it may be worthwhile to have a discussion with folks at PEB to see if that needs to be also inserted in the PEB statute. And I'm happy to answer any other questions if the committee has them.
Thank you. Are there any questions, Ms. Galley? Okay, thank you very much for the information. Okay, Let these guys up next, or these guys? Who do you want up next? These guys or those guys? Okay. Okay, next, Mary Botkin, Randy Ritterbush. Ritterbush? Or Mary Botkin.
I seem to have been abandoned by my colleague. For the record, my name is Mary Botkin, representing African Council 75. You know, I don't know whether it's for good or for bad, but I was actually here for the 1991 workers' comp reforms. And this actually was an area of the law that we thought we had fixed. And it's probably one of the few things that we agreed to with Senator Durfler at the time. But be that as it may, let me just say that this issue was brought forward by our members who work with the mentally retarded and the developmentally disabled individuals who live in state-operated group homes. And I have to say that this is one of the toughest areas to represent that we have. The work environment is very violent and very abusive for the workers who work there. And, you know, it's through no fault of the client. They have very little impulse control, and, you know, it is just a very hard, tough job to do. These workers don't make very much money. They are some of our lower paid members. And so when they get hurt on the job, all they want is to get better because they don't have the luxury of sort of living off their savings because they don't have much in savings, if anything. And so this is really a critical piece of getting them back to work as soon as we can. And understand that from our union's perspective, the minute a person is injured on the job, it is our goal to get them back to work. It is their goal to get back to work because that's really what they want to do. And when we get into a situation where we have insurance companies fighting over who's going to pay for the health care and the medical treatment that that worker needs, it becomes very frustrating very fast for those members and for us. It is difficult to explain why they have to go without treatment because two insurance companies are fighting when they're actually paying for health care at work and they have workers' comp and they're waiting for the insurance companies to decide who's going to pay. At this point, all we want is for somebody to pay for their care, somebody to step up and take responsibility. That's all we want. That's all this bill is for. You know, all the dots and the dashes and the words on the paper don't matter. At the end of the day, that's what all we want to have happen is for the worker to get timely and responsible medical care at the time of the injury so that they get better and that they can get back to work. That's all this bill is supposed to do. And Representative Holvey, thank you. Thank you for doing this. Thank you for grabbing onto this little piece of a bigger problem because this piece keeps people, at least makes them whole in relationship to their injuries. And that's all this bill is supposed to do.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Kinnear.
Maybe more comment. I was there too.
Yes, you were.
And yes, we thought we fixed this problem, and it was supposed to be pretty darn automatic. So.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, last two we have John Powell and Tom Holt, Regents.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Powell. Before you, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. My firm also represents insurers that write some workers' compensation, so I'm somewhat familiar with how both systems work. I think both systems are working very well, but they are totally different and have a different basis for determining eligibility for payment. and they pay different rates. Health insurance usually by contract with providers, whereas in workers' comp there's a fee schedule. So they're very, very different systems. We did have a task force at one point on trying to merge the two called 24-hour care. That ran into kind of the same problem that you're faced with this bill. The two provide similar benefits, medical, but they do it in a different way under different circumstances. So it does create some administrative issues when they come together. We have some concerns with the wording, and we're working with the sponsor, Representative Holvey, and we'll continue to do that. On the issue of pre-authorization, we're not sure exactly how that would work. We do have expedited pre-authorization in case of emergencies for all health plan members. So we want to do some more work in that area and other definitional issues.
Chair Doherty and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. We completely agree that someone who's entitled to health benefits should get them, and someone who's entitled to workers' comp benefits should get them. And Representative Holvey, you have identified a point of friction in the payment system. As Mr. Powell said, there are some significant differences in the coverages between workers' comp and health plans. We may handle, for example, a rotator cuff prior auth differently from the way a workers' comp carrier might process it. I've been through that process myself. I had a shoulder fixed about a year ago. And what we do when we get a claim that may have other coverage, whether it be auto insurance from an accident or something, we don't know what the nature of a claim is when it comes in. Everything's very highly automated when it's incoming. But certain types of claims kick out, and we generate a questionnaire to our member asking them what is the source of the injury. And we ask, was it workplace related? Was it an accident? And so on. And if it's under our coverage, things move on and they get that coverage right away. If it's workers' comp, then we get into this back and forth with the workers' comp carrier. So we're very interested in trying to make this better. As Mr. Powell said, we are concerned about a little bit of the wording, and we appreciate Representative Holby's patience and working with us and others on some of that. The expedited prior authorization is a bit of a puzzle to us because what we do when we have prior authorizations as part of our normal course of business, many of them on a daily basis. The range of time to get those resolved really depends on the complexity. Some things resolve almost as soon as we get them. With very complex cases, it can take a little bit more time and have to be looked at by one of our medical directors. But we do move through those pretty promptly. But in terms of prioritizing our workload, it's really based on the medical need for something to get resolved. Right? If we have someone who needs to get a decision on a major surgery right away because it's kind of an emergent situation, that's going to get looked at immediately versus if something can maybe wait for a more elective process, it's going to go down the line. So we have some concern just about wording and how we do this right so that we make sure that people do get the coverage they need when they need it, and in this in this area, obviously let folks get back to work. They're going to be in much better shape if they can get back to work promptly with coverage. So again, we want our coverage to apply when it's applicable, and we just want to make sure that we don't have unintended consequences in the way that this is addressed. And we appreciate Representative Holvey's diligence on this and working through the issues.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Representative Kinnamer.
If I could, probably more just a comment. This is a pretty dicey area in several ways, both as workers' comp and medical claims. A couple of years ago, I had a work injury. I was working on my cabin, and I fell 17 feet and shattered my shoulder. We shared that experience. It was not pleasant. And the interesting thing is I go to the Reed Ports Hospital, and they don't think an MRI is justified. I stop, make an emergency stop in Eugene, and they don't think an MRI is justified. And 3 weeks later, after raising all kinds of cane and having a horrible time, I get an MRI, and my physician multiplies my pain medicine tenfold, and I'm scheduled for surgery. So it's a complicated thing about how you get prompt treatment and whether you get good treatment and proper treatment. So it's tough. It's a tough struggle because and I have to concur, giving everybody an MRI doesn't make very good sense either. But on the other hand, when you don't diagnose things correctly, then people have extended problems. Had this been a direct real work injury, it would have been a terrific problem because I certainly was unable to use my shoulder for a long period of time.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, there's no one else signed up on the... Oh, yes. Ms. Rowley?
Could I ask a question of Chris Davies?
Sure. Chris Davies is with SAFE. Chris? And we'll need to move on. We have quite a few people for the next bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your indulgence, Madam Chair. And Mr. Davies, I appreciate all the work, and you were very involved in the Dash 1 amendment, as you well know. And Mr. Powell brought up an issue about the differences in fee schedules and payments and the difficulty of trying to work that out between the carriers. And if this bill adopts the fee schedule essentially for the workers' comp carrier as the payment level, can you explain how that works in the proposal?
Sure. Yes. And Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, I'm Chris Davey with SAFE Corporation. I think one of the concerns about these various proposals as we've worked through this over the last 2 or 3 months was, is one party going to start paying the bills and then the other party might have to pay, become liable later on, and then you've got reimbursements going back and forth between insurance companies. I think the Dash 1 amendments take care of that issue because a commitment is made that one or other, either the health insurer or the workers' comp insurer, will be paying the bills, but they don't get paid until that compensability decision is made. So there's no passing of money back and forth. So that takes care of some of those administrative concerns. Generally, the workers' compensation fee schedule pays medical providers at a higher level than health insurance contracts generally do. So if the claim is accepted, then the medical services will be paid according to the medical fee schedule. Just as if that claim were accepted from day one, we would start paying at the workers' compensation fee schedule level. If the claim should be denied, then, of course, it reverts back to the health insurer, and so they would pay the bills according to their contracted rates.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions while Mr. Davies is up here? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, with that, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 4140 and open up the public hearing on House Bill 4119. Okay, we have quite a few people signed up for this, so we're going to give shoot for 9:15 because we have another presentation and a work session after this. So I'd like to call up Marshall Coleman, Marshall Koba and Tim Blackman, please. Thank you. Want to get going? Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. My name is Marshall Koba. I'm here this morning representing the American Council of Engineering Companies in strong support of House Bill 4119. 4119 is a technical fix that will clarify rulemaking on House Bill 3316 that was passed in the 2011 session. 3316 passed unanimously, came out of this committee, and was signed by the governor, And in it, it created three financial thresholds for procurement of design professionals, including engineers, architects, and land surveyors. But as we get started, I just want to put an overall theme on this. I think what we're doing here is efficient. We're talking about local control, and we're talking about proven methodologies that have been used for years. There's a book that's put out called the APWA, the American Public Works Association, is very supportive of this process, the qualification-based selection process. It's a proven methodology. There's nothing new that we're doing here, and we're just trying to clarify the rulemaking from 2011 and 12, which was implemented, which we believe changed the intent of House Bill 3316. So those three thresholds were for large projects, over $250,000 in design fees. And as you say design fees, I want you to think that about 10% of a project cost is design. That's a rough number. So, you know, that would be a $2.5 million project needs to do a full qualification-based selection process, which means that any and all design professionals that may be interested need to be notified and have an opportunity to respond to an RFQ. Request for qualifications. For smaller, for projects from $100,000 to $250,000, you can go out to five selected firms. And so for those projects that are under $100,000 in estimated fees, the bill allowed public agencies to do a QBS selection process, or they may, as the bill said, do a direct appointment process. And this is the section only on those projects under $100,000 that House Bill 4119 seeks to fix. So this allows public agencies to select one firm to discuss the scope and fees on a project. And we believe this acknowledges some of the concerns of local governments, which small projects, those under $100,000 in fees, can be procured in a very efficient manner and in a different manner than required by using the full qualification-based selection process. So during the rulemaking, the Department of Justice ruled that the May in 3316 had the unintended result of allowing local and state governments to use from dollar one, even on small projects, you can use this full-blown qualification-based selection process, or two, you can use the direct appointment process, which is what we want to talk about today, which is a very simple, efficient, as simple and as efficient as you can get, which is simply a local government, state government picking up a telephone and calling a local engineer, architect, or land surveyor and having a conversation about scope and fee and then beginning work. And I've got a letter in the back of here from the city of Eugene, which is attached to my testimony. I want to point out a few in there as they support the bill, but how they use this. But what the May also said, the Department of Justice said, is that May is not only limited to those two. May also may include a bidding process, a hybrid process, or any other process that a local or state government deemed appropriate in procuring design professionals. That was not the intent of 3316, and we support the interpretation of May to allow a QBS process or a direct appointment process only, and that was our intent. House Bill 4119 will not impact projects more than $100,000 in fees, as the intent of that portion of the bill was not changed through rulemaking. Last session, in 2013, we introduced Senate Bill 640-304, which passed out of the Senate Business Committee and through the Senate floor 28-0. Then we came over to the House Consumer Affairs Committee, and after the first hearing, we developed some amendments that addressed many of the concerns of local governments who testified in opposition. And the language in this bill also addresses many of their concerns and makes it clear that price is a major component of direct appointment as it is with the QBS process. So, House Bill 4119 fixes the loophole from the rulemaking and allows state and local governments to use either a QBS solution or a direct appointment methodology to select design professionals. We believe there is a small group of agencies that continue to bid design, and this legislation will bring consistency across the state as bidding has been shown to not be the appropriate method in selecting design professionals. And as it says here, we want the record to show that may means that state and local governments may use either a QBS process and described in Section 1, or they may choose to make a selection of a design professional by the direct appointment process. So they have a choice of QBS or direct appointment. May does not allow any other than these two choices for selecting a design professional for projects under $100,000 in estimated fees. And as if I can go to the Kurt Corey, the attachment behind my testimony, This was a letter from Kirk Corey. Kirk Corey is the Public Works Director from the City of Eugene. He's been instrumental in the American Public Works Association. He served on the review panel that updates the APWA Red Book. He's active nationally in the American Public Works Association. And I'm not going to read the whole thing in here, but he talks about APWA. But he's a couple of points that I'd like to state here. Many who have expressed concerns regarding QBS have what I believe to be the mistaken impression that it precludes asking for price, for cost information, and essentially mandates that agencies enter into contracts they cannot afford. What does not always seem to be clearly understood is that cost is always a factor. QBS simply underscores the prudent approach in negotiating professional service agreements with the most qualified firms. And continuing on, Kurt Corey also wrote, I would note, and this is what the City of Eugene does, I would note the City of Eugene enters into numerous small consultant contracts each year using the direct appointment provisions of the statute. We maintain a pool directory of qualified firms for various types of work and pick up the phone to ask for a proposal as the need arises. Repeat, we pick up the phone and ask for a proposal as the need arises. I don't know how anything could be more efficient than that. Back to quoting Mr. Corey, once we have received the proposal, we negotiate costs. If we are unable to agree on an acceptable price, we simply call the next firm on the list who we believe to be the next best qualified. Many believe that was the intent of previous legislation, and House Bill 4119 aptly, in my opinion, provides that clarification. It's also important to note the key to good design. I mean, when hiring an engineer architect, it's beyond the design phase. The design phase in a QBS process creates a team approach. Case studies have found that the bid creates conflict, internal conflict, because you've got somebody maybe who's doing it for less money than they actually think it should have been done for, but they wanted the work. It leads to change orders, it leads to problems, and it leads to conflict as you head into the construction phase. Of course, what the engineer and architect do then leads into the construction phase. Good plans lead to good construction. Things stay on budget, things stay on time, and you don't have change fees. Then the other thing you need to remember is the decisions made today about who your designer is last for the life cycle of that structure. And if it's a building, if it's a school, it's 50, 60, 70 years. You've got to maintain it. You've got to heat it. You've got to cool it. You've got to staff it. All the decisions made on day one have an impact on that for the next 50 to 75 or however long that structure is standing there. And that's why it's important to have qualified design on the front end. So we just want to make sure, last night I was looking at the website and I noticed some of the testimony was put up, our comments were put up there, and there were some others. And I just want to make sure that the opposition, as you listen to it, that it hits the mark. Some of it seems to be off of the mark a little bit. And I reviewed, talking about price. Price is a huge consideration in this. We all know we're not asking for a blank check and a contract that is with an unfilled dollar amount. That's maybe we'd like that, but it's not something we're going to come to the legislature and pass. Inefficiencies, I don't think that there's anything more efficient than what Mr. Corey from the City of Eugene talks about on small projects, picking up the phone, calling a local engineer of his choice, who he thinks is qualified to do the work, talking about fee, talking about scope, and getting to work. And then there's some concerns raised about impacts on local business. We are local business. Mr. Blackwood is a local business. All of us are local businesses here. That's our membership who support this process. So in conclusion, the bill takes effect in January 2015. We pledge to work with local and state governments this summer and fall to implement an ongoing educational process. We did that when the QBS passed in 2011. This will ensure the proper implementation next January and help realize our long-stated goals of consistency from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, from project to project. And this process has been proven to provide the best value and the best use of the limited public funds that we have in Oregon. Thank you for your consideration.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Brief questions, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Barton.
Mr. Koba, just anticipating perhaps what I think the opposition will say, let me give you a chance to respond. Why should we tie the hands of local government? They can do this right now. Why should we require it?
Chair Doherty, Representative Barton, I think the vast majority of local governments in Oregon are doing this already. And I think all we're doing here is picking up some outliers that are continuing to use the bidding process. The bidding process has been proven to not be the best use of public funds because it, again, leads to change orders, leads to litigation. The American Public Works Association, the American Bar Association support this process. It allows local control of what's going on here, and the bidding process has just been proven to not be the most effective. And the other thing is, too, that there's an expense to it. I mean, if you want to talk about efficiencies in government, there can't be anything more efficient than picking up and having a conversation. And that's what the direct appointment is and the price and the selection is. The selection is who you call originally. So if Oregon City wanted to call Coba Engineering and have a conversation, that's selection. But we sure haven't gone to a contract phase at that point. We're having a conversation and a negotiation about that price and about that scope. So if we can't agree on that, then you have the ability to go to the second one. But it's been a long-standing position of the American Public Works Association, our association. It works better to not bid design.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Holvey?
Thank you. And along those same veins, I would like you to address, I think you did in your testimony, but I have heard some issues about you know, having to go through the selection process and then coming to a point where you don't agree on the price, and that at that point they have to start the selection process all over again and go clear back to the RFP. And correct me if I'm wrong, but wouldn't that RFP, as you described it or Mr. Corey described it, you have an RFP go out, you've got several people that respond to that, and you just kind of go through them, pick the best qualified. If you can't agree on the price, you don't have to go back to an RFP and start the selection process all over again.
Chair Doherty, Representative Holvey, that's correct. And remember, we're talking about the small projects under $100,000 in fees. So the process is incredibly efficient and incredibly simple. You do not have to go back out. And the vast majority of the time, if I were to get the phone call, however, the engineering firm or the architectural firm that received the phone call, we're going to agree on a price. But no, you do not need to go back. And the bigger, in the full-blown, over $250,000 in fees in the qualification-based selection process on bigger projects, yes, if you get down the road and you're in negotiation and you're in, developing the scope and you realize that it's not going to work out, then you do go back to the second-rate firm. But you don't have to go back to the whole process because multiple firms have already responded to the RFQ. So you know who your second-rate firm is and you begin the process with them. So there's more of a process there. What we're trying to do here is keep this as simple and as efficient as possible.
And one quick another question. Another one of the fears, I guess, out there is because of the perhaps perceived lack of flexibility that the big firms will be the ones that get all the work and the smaller firms won't be able to even compete at this smaller price point.
Chair Doherty, Representative Holvey, I mean, it's interesting that it's totally up to local control on this is 100%. Who they choose to work with and how they choose to work with that firm is up to them. We had a meeting last week, a legislative committee meeting, and it's in a bid process. Actually, a lot of our larger firms aren't even going after that work. It's just not worth their time and energy to chase the low dollar to be in that. So what the bid process also does is it kind of just by its process precludes a number of firms from even being involved and being interested in the work.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you. Mr. Blackman, if you could add to the testimony, we're looking at time a little bit. You'll understand, I'm this time person.
Okay.
Everyone else in the audience realizes this. So if you could just add to the testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Tim Blackwood. I'm a geotechnical engineer, a principal at a company called Hart Krauser, about 110-person firm. We have a 20-person office in Beaverton. I've been doing engineering for about 21 years, and prior to Hart Krauser, I started a company called Pacific Geotechnical, based in Oregon City, Oregon. About 8 people. We sold that company to Hart Krauser in 2011. Before I go further, I apologize to Representative Martin. I sent him a letter yesterday and said I was in his district. Actually, personally, I don't live there. I live in Representative Kennemer's district. But
all right, I'll still be nice to you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Hopefully, that won't make a difference in your decision. But I do want to explain a little bit about engineering services, how they differ from products and projects. Then I'd like to not readdress what Marshall said, but maybe give you a perspective from a practitioner and a small business side on that, some examples that illustrate that. So basically, engineering services and architectural services are different than a washing machine. You can go to a store, you can look at a washing machine, you can see how they function, you can pick which one is best for you. A building that's constructed by a contractor, the design, the plan, specifications are all there. When you get bids, you're getting bids for that building. With design services, you don't have that luxury. Design services basically sometimes can be very complex projects, can involve a lot of parties, a lot of things. You need to look at maintenance costs, you need to look at construction methods, all those kinds of things. So once you hire a design firm, you're kind of stuck with that project. You know, like Marshall said, maybe 50, 60 or more years. So it's different than just a product that you can look at from the shelf. And because of that, that's why APWA and others support a quality qualifications-based selection process. So you get a firm that knows how to do it. They have that experience. And I think that Marshall addressed some of the issues in terms of typical objections we see to this. I understand those. I do want to say that as a small business, Pacific Geotechnical with 8 people, we were involved with some projects where we were direct appointed. It didn't preclude us from those. One project we're just finishing up now. We started in 2009 by a city that had a problem with a road. A road was constructed. It's settled. They had to close the road because it got so bad. They came to Pacific Geotechnical because some unique capabilities we had, hired us to come in, figure out what the problem was, support them in getting an award to repair that road. We're designing that road, and it just reopened recently. And that was based on our qualifications. We weren't precluded from that. So that didn't preclude a small company from going after those kinds of projects. Also, as a small business, Pacific Geotechnical, we did direct point work with ODOT. ODOT was working on a project. Many of you who commute in the Portland area know of commonly the Twilliger Curves are putting a giant wall in there. They had to do a lot of exploratory work on that. When they were doing that, it was a bad winter. ODOT had to quickly respond to some emergencies. They talked to Pacific Geotechnical because we had some unique experience doing explorations in that kind of terrain. We got in there as their staff, did that work for them until they could get back on the job, off their emergency stuff, and help them out. Again, that went to us as a small firm. So it is those kinds of opportunities aren't precluded by this process from a practitioner standpoint. And so I think hopefully that kind of illustrates some of the things that Marshall said. And with that, I'll quit here because I know you're short on time. I would appreciate your support, and thank you very much for allowing me to speak to you.
Okay, thank you. Do you have any questions for Mr. Blackwood? Okay, thank you, gentlemen, very
thank
much.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have Matt Michael, Gail Murray, and Rob Bovette.
And Madam Chair, Rob Bovette, on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties and Legal Counsel, I'm actually going to keep it about 2 seconds and invite you to, in the interest of time, mm-hmm. AOC is strongly opposed to this bill for the reasons you're going to hear from the actual purchasing managers, and I would ask you to call Brian Smith up in my place, and I'll step down and expedite this.
Fine, thank you. Is he on the list?
He is.
Thank you. When you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. My name is Matt Michael. I'm the general manager at Canby Utility. I'll make my comments as brief as I can. Brief introduction. Canby Utility is a water and electric utility for the city of Canby. We are independent from the city of Canby. We operate under fees. We do not provide have any property tax support. We support the city, actually, through general fund contribution as a payment in lieu of taxes. I am also representing the Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association, OMU is what I'll refer to them as, 11 electric utilities in Oregon, small, medium-sized utilities, also providing electric, providing water services. In my written testimony, I provided you some information about OMU and then also a brief history about QBS as it's been entered in the record. I'll quickly jump to my testimony, which is at the top of page 2. I do appreciate the opportunity today to express OMU's opposition to House Bill 4119. The House bill is effectively the same as Senate Bill 644, which was introduced and failed in the last legislative session. What has changed is the tone, where Senate Bill 644 said we may not use pricing to select a contractor for projects under $100,000. Now House Bill 4119 says we can use pricing, but only after we have selected the contractor. To our perspective, it's wordplay. Under either bill, we, smaller municipal electric utilities, would need to engage more contractors to run the QBS negotiation process. The current competitive bid process for smaller projects works for OMU members, and so we do not support House Bill 4119. And I'll end my testimony there and, I guess, open floor to my colleagues or any questions.
Okay. Do you have any questions of the gentleman? His testimony is on the OLIS system. Okay. Thank you, sir.
Good morning, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. My name is Brian Smith, and I'm the purchasing manager for Multnomah County. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity today to speak in opposition to this bill. In addition to limiting the number of smaller local firms and state MWSB-certified firms winning these contracts, this bill would create an administrative contradiction and likely additional procurement costs for Multnomah County. Specifically, this bill would increase the ambiguity regarding the appropriate procurement process and create likelihood that we become retroactively in violation of our own selection processes. I'd like to illustrate for you what this looks like at a local jurisdiction. For public agencies, the requirements for the process to select a vendor to provide goods and services is largely dependent upon price and sometimes what you're buying. For A&E and related services, we currently conduct a direct appointment for up to $100,000. We follow an informal selection process between $100,000 and $150,000. And over $150,000, we follow a formal selection process. That formal limit, which is tied solely to the dollar amount of A&E services we intend to purchase, has requirements attached to it for public advertisement and vendor protest rights. These requirements increase procurement risk to the county, but they're also important elements of maintaining a transparent and accountable public procurement. At the beginning of a procurement process, I work with our engineers and project managers who use these services to determine what the appropriate selection process should be. I ask them what their cost estimate is and recommend the appropriate selection process based largely on that. In Multnomah County, if the estimate's $150,000 or more, it's easy. We use a formal qualifications-based selection process. For projects that are less than $150,000, there's a concern that without any pricing, we may actually embark on a direct appointment or an informal selection process, select a vendor, and find out, as we're negotiating the contract, that we should have publicly advertised this opportunity. At that point, we've invested significant resources in the selection process, have the best qualified firm ready to do the work, and are out of compliance with our procurement process. Having the clear delineation between the different levels, which prescribe what kind of public selection process we need to follow, is important to maintain so that public agencies can remain accountable for the public dollars we spend on A&E and related services. Maintaining that delineation is important for Multnomah County to be compliant with public purchasing rules. It's important to small businesses and state MWSB-certified businesses because of the increased opportunities to win public work. And it's important for instilling taxpayer confidence in the integrity of the public contracting process. Thanks again for the opportunity to testify, and I would welcome any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you. Do you have any questions? Okay, thank you very much. And
good morning, Chair Doherty and committee members. Excuse me. My name is Gail Murray, and I'm the purchasing risk manager for Eugene Water and Electric Board, or EWEB. I was here last year to speak to you in opposition of Senate Bill 644, and here again today to talk to you in opposition of House Bill 41-119. I have my testimony all prepared, and I'm in the interest of time. I know last year I gave you a little bit of an analogy about buying a car, purchasing a car, and how can you do this without knowing what the price is, and I know you probably all have heard that story, so I want to rehash that. There are a couple of things that I did want to address. I know that... I'm just a little bit. They're scaring me to death.
No, we're nice up here. We're nice.
The previous speakers were talking. They read the letter from Kirk Corey, who is from the city of Eugene, public works director. And what he was talking about was a small procurement process for small purchases, and where he can pick up the phone. He's got a list of providers. Well, EWIP has the same thing, and that's for. For small projects. And Representative Barton, I appreciated your question earlier about, well, if we can do this already, why do we need to have something that's going to change the law? What is the point to this? So for small, I'm wondering if maybe it might be helpful to, if I explain the difference a little bit between procurement processes. There is a bid process. We call it invitation to bid, and that term has been kind of bandied about as something that people use for if they're soliciting for architects and engineers. And I really don't know any public agency that uses that process for these types of services. Mm-hmm. Back in maybe the 80s, and I've actually been around that long, in procurement, you know, there were RFPs were not common. People did do bids. And those are the types of things that are brought forward when they brought this initial QBS bill was, I think they gave an example of a failed bridge, and because that was low bid, and because it was low bid, you know, these problems existed. Currently, there is an RFP process which takes into consideration price as well as qualifications, minimum qualifications, terms and conditions, their acceptance of our terms and conditions, all kinds of negotiations goes into that. And so when you add the layer of the QBS process on top of that, so you go through your typical RFP process, basically. So you put out your scope of work, you put out what your terms and conditions are, all the information that your minimum qualifications, and you get your responses in, you evaluate them based on that, and a lot of that criteria has to do with experience. And then once you have that information, you're scored, you're ranked, and all of that is included in your scoring, and the price is included there. So the agencies know up front what it is they're, you know, what the cost is going to be, and they want to have the most qualified. Our goal is to find the best value and the best qualified providers for our services. Now, when you add the QBS process on top of that, what happens is you get to that point, you've got your top-ranked person, and you then enter in, without knowing what the cost is. So now you enter into negotiations with them. And it's not as easy as picking up a phone. I'm talking about more formal process also. But it's not as easy as picking up a phone at that point. You can't. You have your RFP process in place. You then, if you can't come to agreement, and that isn't something that takes just a day. That takes a long time to negotiate up to that point. You're talking about terms and conditions and all the other factors. And then once you get to that point and you realize, well, this is above our budget, or we just can't afford this. So now you start over. And when I say over, you don't start the RFP process over, but you start from where you started negotiations with firm one. Now you start firm two. And this, I mean, negotiations can take sometimes months with one firm. So if you're dealing with that, what the potential really is we have projects, and everybody else does. We have a small window of opportunity for construction projects. There's a short window when we can do those. So we start our timeline out far enough so we can have the architects and engineers on board. So if you get to the point where your timeline is crunched, what do you think really would happen if you're negotiating with firm one? It takes all this time, and they give you the price, and you think, gosh, this is really too high, but I don't have a choice right now. I can't stop here and go back and start over. I don't have the luxury of time for my project, or we'll be doing this project next year. So that's just one kind of an example of how that could come into play.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions to the panel?
Yeah.
You look like you have a question, Representative Fagan.
Well, I certainly appreciate you guys coming down. It sounded like the process that you just described there was very formal, and I wasn't here in 2011 when this bill was initially passed, so I'm playing a little bit of catch-up, but I've read through the bill and the testimony, and it sounds to me like the process you just described is one option, or there can be a direct appointment, which the proponents of the bill are saying is as formal, is as informal as making a phone call. So it sounds to me like you described a process that is maybe somewhat arduous. It sounded to me like the intent of the bill in 2011 was to say you can do that, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. you can pick up the phone, and you know, and the act of picking up the phone is the selection process, and then at that point you discuss fees and scope, and if that design firm isn't able to mm-hmm. give you the project at the fees that you want, then you hang up the phone and you dial the next one. And that's, so it sounds to me like there was, you described a process that sounds formal. I thought the intent of the 2011 bill was to say, well, if you like that, you can do it, or you can do this much more informal process. And what I hear the proponents of this bill saying is, we want people to use one of those two processes, not kind of or anything else.
Right, which is what we currently have the ability to do. We do that now. So under $150,000, we're able to do that, directly appoint. So I guess that was the question, is why do we need to make a change to something that's already working for small procurements? But you're right, I was talking a little bit. I guess I was just trying to kind of give you an overview of how this whole thing came to be. And really our only saving grace as agencies was the ability to direct negotiate under $100,000 to be able to negotiate with our small local firms.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Just a real quick one for the committee. Thank you, Madam Chair. So can you just walk me through, because there's been, I read through testimony and I'll listen. Thank you, Jan, for putting that on there. But 644 passed out, I mean, unanimously, 28-0. There were two people excused. Was everybody asleep at the wheel? Was there no concern when 644 got rolled out? What happened? And that's not for everybody to answer. That's just for one individual. Choose your best person and kind of explain to me why this became such a big deal and why the bill comes to the House in April and dies in July.
Do you have a history?
Who wants to handle that?
We take volunteers.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Matthews, as I understand it, is that not much attention was paid on that side of the legislature. When it got over to here with momentum is when I know our association woke up to it and said, wow, what's happening here? And so that's where I think basically the attention rallied around it and said, wait a second, this needs to slow down and have some thought out discussion on it.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. We have four more people to speak in about 10 minutes or less. So call up Mike Biesner and Scott Winkles and Mark Landauer.
Madam Chair, I just want to put for the record, the committee received testimony and support from Larry Fox representing OBEC Consulting Engineers, also from Monica Anderson with the Balzazer Hubbard Engineers, and testimony opposed from Medford Water Commission, City of Beaverton, and City of Wilsonville.
Thank you very much. Okay, gentlemen, you've got about 10 minutes or less.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Biesner. I'm the county engineer for Clackamas County, been there about 15 years. And I was here last year testifying as well, and the House committee actually in this meeting said, what was that, Senate committee asleep when they considered this? That was their quote, because they were kind of surprised it passed out of the Senate. The reality is we're not talking about buildings here. We're talking about small, straightforward, pretty mundane tasks, usually. QBS is great. We use it all the time, obviously. We do a lot of big work in Clackamas County. Its intent is great. It keeps people safe. My job is to keep people safe. But when we have something small, and we don't just cold call people who are not qualified, yet we do pick up the phone. But it is great to be able to pick up three firms you already know are qualified for a pretty simple task and just say, oh, and how much will it cost? It's not going to hurt the quality one bit. It's more efficient for us. It's less expensive for us. And then we could spend our dollars on things that actually do keep people safe. So we're asking that you not make this modification. We like it the way it is. We actually lost a lot 2 years ago, in my opinion, when the law changed to begin with, and we don't want to see our local control taken away further. And I'll keep it brief. I submitted some testimony. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you so much. Any questions? Okay, thank you. Next.
For the record, Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm appearing in opposition to this legislation. And we did testify against Senate Bill 644 on the Senate side and on the House side. I think you've heard from several public procurement professionals in the state of Oregon who've told you that this bill would complicate their efforts and complicate their and add cost and inefficiency to the process. The League does not see any substantive difference between this legislation and 644 that was rejected by the House General Government Committee last session. These changes appear to be largely semantics. If the proponents had really wanted to address local government concerns, I think the process would have been a meaningful dialogue between the parties. There was no invitation to do so. We had no inkling the bill was being introduced until it was dropped. There was no communication with the stakeholder group. Oregon city procurement professionals take their jobs very seriously, and contracting boards, which are your city councils, take stewardship of the public funds very seriously. We're talking about small projects where there's not state participation, where there's no state nexus, and we would urge you to retain the local decision-making authority of these elected bodies. And what's more, I think it's a bridge too far to say that we've seen a benefit from the changes in 2011. I think with the League's looking at some analysis and going to take looking at some in-depth study of how the QBS changes made in 11 have actually impacted, and if we've actually seen a public benefit, and come back for a conversation about that in 2015. And with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague, and I'm eager for your questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, Ms. Landauer, briefly, please.
You bet.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon and the Oregon Public Ports Association. This morning you've heard a number of reasons why our associations also oppose the measure that is currently before you. Just to be brief, I'd like to provide you just one additional example of why this is an important issue for our membership. The concerns about delays in selecting a professional architect, engineer, et cetera, is very important in the sense of if you delay a project as a result of not being able to get to an agreement on price. There are certain projects for which my clients do that have very narrow windows of in-water work. Ports, water districts, sewer districts all have to conduct some types of work in water where the in-water work window is very narrow. If you miss that window, you are delayed for as much as a year to be able to get to that next window. Obviously, that increases price. It delays construction of public works that are for the benefit of the public. Our concerns are outlined, of course, in the written testimony that I've provided you. I just wanted to provide an additional example of why this legislation that's before you could be very problematic for the clients that I represent today. Thank you, Madam Chair, and if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Landauer? Okay, thank you very much. And the last two, Eric Peterson, Dave Simmons, very briefly. We have to go through and pass something onto the floor, and then we also have an informational hearing on unemployment.
Sure.
So,
thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dave Simmons. I am the president of the American Council of Engineering Companies of Oregon. I also work for CH Tom Hill. I just want to make a couple of quick comments. I think we're focused on the 100,000 or less, the small projects. But nonetheless, there are details in developing a work plan for even a small project that I think what concerns, what we end up with from the consulting side is an apples and oranges situation where each firm is left to interpret interpret what that scope of services is in preparing the price, and often there is a lack of dialogue between the parties at that stage. And so we're saying that it's that conversation is important, but let's not ask all of the firms that you're soliciting to go through that process. Let's select the firm that you think is the best qualified. In this case, you can go through a QBS process, or you can select the firm and negotiate. And the firms that are the agencies that are adopting that process are finding that it is very efficient. It's not a time or a staff burden. It's actually quite quick, and they can, 9 times out of 10 or more, they're negotiating a reasonable scope of services for that. This is not an issue. I work for a large firm. Eric works for a 10-person firm of his own. This is not an issue that separates us here. We both, there are qualified firms like our own that are making decisions not to pursue that work because we feel like it, from a business standpoint, it creates apples and oranges where we're spending dollars to respond to these RFPs in a way that we don't feel there is a fair comparison in what services, and there's, when cost is an element, it becomes an overriding distraction and a political element of the decision, rather than focusing on what are the services that are needed and do you have the best firm at hand.
Thank you.
My name is Eric Peterson. I'm the managing principal of Peterson Structural Engineers, and we are a 12-person single-discipline engineering firm in Portland. And so I come before you as a small business, and so any other testimony or statements about the effect of QBS on small business being a negative is, as far as I'm concerned, very wrong. I have been in business for 18 years. I rarely compete on price because I have built a client base, and I work for many, many municipalities who pick up the phone and say, Eric, I want you to work for me. Let's negotiate a scope and fee. I've never once had one of them say, Eric, that's too much. Eric, you're gone too far. Eric, we can't afford this. They know this based on my qualifications. The other thing I would say is $100,000. If 10% of the design fees is $100,000, then, or of a project, 10% of a project, then this is a $1 million project. And that is not a small thing. A bad design, a low qualified design, leads to a bad project that can cost much more. So I'm an advocate of this. I practice this. Bid-based request for proposals don't normally have access to my services because I'm not willing to bid that way. And the other testimony that I've heard, most people are using this anyway. We think it's best practice to not use price when you're selecting a design professional. Does anybody have any questions for me?
Any questions? Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate, and the committee, I really appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. Okay, that's the last person we had signed up for the hearing. Anybody else? If not, I close the public hearing on House Bill 4119, and I open up a work session on House Bill 4010. This is the one that they heard Monday. Jan, if you could do a little summary to especially remind me, since I was not here.
Okay, Madam Chair, committee members, Measure 4010, it authorizes the Employment Department to make public all decisions of the Employment Appeals Board and apply to all decisions made before, on, or after the effective date, declares an emergency effective on passage. There is no revenue impact, there's no fiscal impact, and there's no amendment.
Okay, thank you. Something important?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4010 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Barton moves House Bill 4010 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, clerk, will you please read the roll?
Representative Fagan?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Yes.
This bill was this.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative
Tolman? Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Representative Weidner?
Yes.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kinnemer?
Aye.
Chair Doherty.
Aye. Okay, motion passes. Is there anyone who would like to carry this bill? If not, Representative Barton. Oh, Representative Holvey, would you like to? Because Representative Barton said he would too.
Okay. He's the vice chair. He outranks.
I defer to my elder.
He's quicker.
Okay, we got vice chair and elder here. So, okay. Well, we'll go to vice chair. So, Representative Barton, if you can carry this bill, I appreciate it.
If you need any help, let me know.
Yes, please. If you need any sage advice, there. Okay, so I close the public hearing on House Bill 4010, and I open an informational hearing on the Employment Division on the loss of federal emergency employment benefits, which is a very timely topic as to what's going on right now. So we have Graham Slater, David Gershenfeld, and Agnes Balassa, and anyone else who would like to come up.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Graham Slater, and I'm the research administrator with the Employment Department. I'll ask someone else to click on slides for me.
I can do that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Move the microphone just a little bit, not really close to you, but just in line with
pointed.
You. Thank you very
happily.
Much.
My job this morning is like a 2 or 3 minute quick overview of the unemployment situation.
You have a half an hour.
Well, I think other people would like to join. But I'm just setting the context for you with the big statistical unemployment picture, and then David will talk more specifically about the unemployment insurance program and extensions and so on, and then Agnes Balassa from the Governor's Office will talk about other broader policy options to help these many unemployed people. So, again, for today at least, I'm just sort of a quick setting the context. If we can go to that first slide. So, as most of you know, the number of unemployed, I mean, some of you have heard me say this in the last few years, the number of unemployed just skyrocketed during the early years and months of this recession, much more than in some other recessions, and that's represented by the whole total area in the graph that you're looking at. And within that top part, the shading there, that represents people who are unemployed for more than 6 months. So characterizing those as the long-term unemployed. And I think the key number there is that before the recession in Oregon, there were about 10,000 people unemployed more than 6 months. By the worst of the recession, it was 100,000. So, I mean, a tenfold increase is unheard of in most statistics, certainly in this one. The good news is it's back down to about 40,000. But that's still a lot more than the 10,000 we started with. So 40,000 Oregonians right now have been unemployed, regardless of whether they're getting benefits or even ever got benefits. I'm just talking Oregonians unemployed right now more than 6 months. Interestingly, if you look at the bottom shading there, the short-term unemployment numbers are back to just about the same as the pre-recession levels. So that does suggest that with the jobs that we've added in the last couple of years, people who are newly unemployed, they are actually getting back into work fairly quickly on average. It's the people that have been out of work a long time who are still struggling to get back into it. The next slide here, the big picture, the big shading on this is the total labor force. And, you know, you could ask the question, well, what happens to those unemployed? You know, why do they stop being unemployed? I mean, the obvious answer and the one we want is that they found jobs. That's true for many of them. Some of them, though, they disappeared. And some people often ask us, well, what about those discouraged workers? You know, you're not counting those. They're still around, but they're not in the labor force anymore because they just gave up. And the main point of this slide is that the really small shading at the top of the graph, that's an estimate, and it's a very hard number to estimate, but it's an estimate of discouraged workers, and it's about 6,000. So my point here is, yes, we care very much about discouraged workers, but in the grand scheme of the numbers, it is only 4,000, 5,000, 6,000. It's not like 10,000, 20,000, 30,000. So we wanted to make that clear. There are, of course, other people leaving the labor force because they're retiring, and that's part of that whole baby boom generation. And some of them may be retiring earlier than they planned because they were unemployed for a while, and they've just chosen then to move into retirement more quickly. If we can move to the next one. We all know people who have been unemployed. We may sort of see them in employment offices and so on. And I think it's easy for us to base our assumptions on people we know or people, relatives, who have been unemployed. So we might think, oh, it's all young people. You know, they graduated. They never did find a job. They're still looking. Or we might think it's all people in their 50s. And what this graph attempts to show in the pie, in the circle part, is that the long-term unemployed are pretty equally spread across all these age groups. So, you know, if you're thinking about, oh, it's all about this one demographic, then I'm just encouraging you to see, no, it's spread very widely across all age groups. It is true, the little numbers on the right, it is true that for people 55 and over, they are actually more likely within their group, almost half of them, if they're unemployed, almost half of them are long-term unemployed, which is a higher percentage than those other groups. But there's a lot more young and mid-aged people in the workforce than there are 55 and olders. So when we look at all of the long-term unemployed, it's pretty equally distributed. Looking at the male-female breakout, it is more heavily distributed towards men. Men make up a slightly higher percentage of the labor force, a slightly even more higher percentage of the unemployed, and a slightly even more higher percentage of the long-term unemployed. And if you think about this particular recession with huge hits in construction, manufacturing particularly, that's not that surprising because those industries do typically have more male employees than female employees. So we know that early in the recession, a lot more men were becoming unemployed, mostly because of the industries that were heavily hit in those early days. And then the last one is just a summary of a couple of completely unrelated pieces of information. Some of you may have heard last week on OPB or National Public Radio, there was a new study where a gentleman sent out fake resumes to companies and wanted to find out if he controlled for experience, even in the industry, were companies more or less likely to even respond and give an interview if the person had links of unemployment. And just to take a 30-odd page report into two lines here, one of the things he found was that if people, again, controlled for all that other stuff, if people were only out of work for 1 month, they were likely to get an interview after sending 10 resumes. If they were out of work for 7 months, it took about 35 resumes. And that is, again, I want to emphasize, controlling for age and the industry they worked in. I mean, this was a very scientific study. It does point out clearly the challenges that someone who's been unemployed for more than 6 months is going to face. The bottom part of that is actually from a presentation I gave several years ago where I invited businesses to just talk to me during a lunch presentation about whether or not they were concerned about hiring people who had been unemployed. And this was early days of the recession. And it just gives you sort of a snapshot of what actual Oregon businesses said to us even 4 years ago. I'm sure some of those things are the same. So if it's okay with you, I'll just pass this to David, and he'll continue with unemployment insurance.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, David Gerstenfeld, Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance at the Employment Department, and want to talk a little bit about specifically the unemployment insurance program and how this helps some of those people. As Graham mentioned, not all of the people who are long-term unemployed are receiving benefits, but certainly a number of them did. So kind of the context for that is that the typical unemployment insurance program, when we're not having additional programs, it provides up to 26 weeks or 6 months of benefits to people. And those benefits come out of the state unemployment insurance trust fund that is paid for by business payroll taxes. So Oregon employers pay that tax that's used to pay the benefits. During the recession, there were a series of federal extensions, about a dozen pieces of legislation, that added another 73 weeks of benefits, and the number of additional weeks fluctuated over time. Most recently, it was down to an additional 37 weeks. So many of you probably heard about the 99 weeks of benefits that were available. Those were the 26 weeks of state benefits, plus those 73 weeks of federal benefits. Those federal extensions were not paid out of the state trust funds, so it didn't really impact employer tax rates directly the same way that the regular benefits do. There were also some state extension programs at various points during the recent recession. As of the last week of 2013, there were no extension programs that were active in Oregon. So the only benefits that people could receive were those 26 weeks of unemployment insurance benefits. The impact of that in Oregon was about 17,500 people, which is about 30% of the people that were receiving unemployment benefits at the time, stopped receiving any unemployment insurance benefits. Over the course of this year, it's an average of about another 900 people per week that would have moved on to an extension program if the federal extensions continued, but won't and will not receive any benefits as a result. And that is an average, so it fluctuates over the course of the year. So we were asked to look at what some possibilities are if the legislature does opt to do another state extension program. And before I talk about how these can be looked at, there are a lot of variables that can be considered. Looking at who gets the benefits, how long they get the benefits, the amount of benefits they receive, and any number of other variables. Those variables have a really big impact in how many people are helped and how long they're helped. Also, obviously, a big impact on the cost to actually pay the benefits and to administer the program. Some of the variables that are looked at are whether it would be retroactive or not. So there is still some discussion at the federal level about the possibility of a federal extension. The most recent proposal would have that being retroactive back to when the prior extension ended. So that obviously provides continuity benefits for people, but also makes it a little bit more difficult to administer. Depending on how those variables are structured in any extension program, it also impacts how quickly we would be able to start paying those extension benefits and how difficult it would be to do that accurately without having any additional improper payments. So what we looked at for these scenarios that are listed were focusing an extension program just on people that were harmed by the end of the federal EUC extensions. So this would be people that are not eligible for any other unemployment benefits, that either stopped getting benefits when the extension program ended or aren't getting benefits this year because the extensions no longer exist for them to move to. And there's basically two ways to structure this. The other state extension programs that were enacted looked at setting a cap on how much was spent on the state programs. So those first two options listed here look at it that way. It's looking at capping the total amount of benefits that would be paid at either $30 million or $50 million. And based on that, you can see estimates of the number of people that would receive at least one additional unemployment insurance benefit check, and then our estimate of the average number of weeks of benefits that people would receive over that program. Then the cost to pay the benefits. The cost to pay the benefits comes out of the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. The cost to administer is just the cost to the Employment Department of running that program. Our administrative costs typically are primarily paid through a federal administrative grant. That grant would not pay for administering a state extension program. The third option here doesn't cap the dollar amount that would be paid in benefits. Instead, it looks at structuring it around how many weeks of benefits would be available. So this is looking at providing another 13 weeks of benefits. And you can see there the number of people that are estimated to receive the benefits and the estimated cost as well. When we're looking at the cost to pay the benefits, I said that those come from the trust fund, so I wanted to give some context as to how that can impact the unemployment insurance tax rates that employers pay in Oregon. We have a self-balancing formula in Oregon that looks at the balance of the trust fund, and as the balance goes down, tax rates go up. We were in the highest tax schedules for the past 3 years, and just this year dropped down into a lower schedule. So this chart shows some projections that show how close we are to either moving up into a higher tax schedule in future years or how close we are to moving down into a lower tax schedule. The bottom line is that any benefits that are paid out of the trust fund at some point need to be replenished through employers paying taxes into the trust fund. Because it's a series of steps, it may not be an immediate impact, but at some point the funds were spent, so it would need to be replenished.
David, we have a question. Representative Holvey.
I think I had a question on the last slide. I was just curious, I don't know if I heard, but the cost to administer, is the trust fund restricted so that the cost to administer could not come out of the trust fund?
Most of the trust fund funds cannot be used to pay the administrative expenses, so that would need there would need to be some other source of funding for those administrative costs, whether it's there's penalty and interest funds, there's CDAF funds, there are options out there, but it's not something that would be paid for through the kind of typical administrative funding for our program.
So do those funds usually come from our general fund for your administrative costs?
There have not typically been general funds allocated to pay to administer the unemployment insurance program.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Continue.
So just using next year as an example, we're projected to stay in the same tax schedule that we're in now. If our trust fund were to drop, if the balance were to drop by $239 million, that would result in us going into a higher tax schedule for next year. So that's what that margin is between us moving up into a higher tax rate. And then the $11 million is that if the balance of the trust fund were to be $11 million higher than projected, we would actually be dropping down into a lower tax schedule. So in looking at the cost of benefits, it's really looking at whether it would either move us into a higher tax rate sooner than we would otherwise, or if it would stop us from dropping down into a lower tax schedule than we otherwise would. And that's kind of a summary of the unemployment insurance aspects of it. Then want to turn it over to Agnes to talk about some of the policy considerations.
For the record, Chair Doherty, members of the committee, I'm Agnes Belasso, the Governor's Policy Advisor for Workforce. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. This is just a slight shift in focus, but as you all are talking about potential extensions, we thought it was also important for us to talk about how to get the long-term unemployed back to work, because as you look at Graham's chart slide that he had there earlier, one of the things that's really evident is that the long-term unemployed, the longer they're away from work, the less desirable they become to employers. And so part of our efforts, while we're also looking at how to provide an insurance and safety net to assure that those who are unemployed can continue to stay afloat, at the same time we're also looking at strategies to assure that we have fewer unemployed, and recognizing that we're in the seventh year of recovery now. On average, we have a recession on the outside about once every 11 years. We could be facing another recession anywhere in 4 to 5 years. So getting those folks back to work is one of the critical policy things we need to talk about, in addition to how do you keep them afloat in an economy that's really challenging. And so part of what we've been doing is some research on what actually works. You may have heard conversations around the fact that we're in a process of talking about a workforce redesign process, and part of the workforce redesign is really about expanding the toolkit that we have to be able to tailor programs for specialized changes in the economy, because our economy is changing and our fluctuations are happening more rapidly, and so some of the tools that we've used in the past may not necessarily be the most effective for the future. So we've started to look at a series of programs to see what shows promise. The research shows that for those who are long-term unemployed, one of the biggest issues for becoming re-employed is that businesses see taking them on as a new employee as a risk. In a hiring decision, businesses are always trying to mitigate risk, trying to find the ideal candidate, the person that will be perfect for them. This becomes a risk factor. And so things that we can do to take some of the risk out of that hiring process become a critical piece. Work attachment seems to be one of those. And work attachment is just a fancy way of saying getting employers to meet these people. We have a number of techniques there, anything from internships, paid and unpaid, volunteer experiences, to actually incenting employers to hire individuals. And then the last piece is around some of the work that's done around cognitive and behavioral approaches, helping people reset their mindsets. Because as you can imagine, as a long-term unemployed person, the things you tell yourself about your value to the workforce are really different than the things that somebody who's gainfully employed says, and they project that as they go forward to employers. And so helping them reset some of their thinking about what they have to offer, what their transferable skills are, and how they can move into the economy. We have a number of programs that have shown some promise, and one of the things we're doing right now is exploring the data on those to see if some of those could be scaled or used in different kinds of settings. One of them, the Claimant Reemployment Program, brings in unemployed individuals to talk with a career counselor earlier in a process, especially after profiling those that are likely to exhaust. So we identify likely to exhaust, bring them in, and have a more intensive relationship with them in the workforce system at the WorkSource centers. We've seen that the research says that reduces unemployment insurance utilization by about 1.1 weeks, which doesn't sound like a lot, but when you've got high numbers of unemployed, it does add up. Our Back to Work Oregon program is one that you all funded in the last session. There's about $6 million in the program right now. What it does is it takes individuals, helps them earn their National Career Readiness Certificate, which certifies that they have the foundational skills to be able to learn on the job, to grow on the job, and then pairs that with an on-the-job training subsidy for the employer. We've seen 90% higher rates, and our initial data showed wages of about $15 an hour, which, while not stellar, is still pretty good for those coming back into work, because typically they start at a lower wage than they left, typically about 80% lower.
Work Opportunity Tax Credit. This is one where, it is a federal program, where employers are offered a tax subsidy for hiring certain types of workers, people with disabilities, veterans, etc. We're exploring to see whether some states are using this tax credit to also focus on the long-term unemployed. We haven't found any that are doing it yet, but it's a question we're exploring. Jobs Plus is a program that's been used with TANF recipients, people who are collecting welfare. It's a program to get hard-to-hire people into jobs and give them work experience through paid internships where the business doesn't pay the internship. The Jobs Plus program pays for it. And again, it's one of those opportunities where once you have somebody on site and you get to know them, often it ends up, I think it's a pretty good hire rate, somewhere around 80% or so. Self-employment program is one another federal program where people can collect unemployment insurance while starting their own business. They're required to form a business plan, work with the Small Business Development Administration, Small Business Development Centers, to create a business plan, and they can collect unemployment insurance while starting up that business for a period of time. It's a small program right now, serving just a few hundred to thousand people, but it's one that we think has potential for scaling. And then this is a program from another state. This is from Connecticut. The Platform to Work program. They take people who are long-term unemployed, put them through a couple of weeks of programming that really focus on resetting your thinking about being unemployed and being employed. They move them into paid internships with companies that are committed to hiring them at the end. And so you've got the best of all worlds there. You've got the full package deal where you help the individual reset. You've got the business committed up front. These programs are options that we're exploring for both the current long-term unemployed and thinking about the future. Challenges for a lot of these programs is that there is a cost of administration and startup, as there are with everything. It takes time to build the coordination, the relationships with businesses, et cetera, to make these happen, as opposed to just cutting checks and doing your traditional service mixes. The opportunities in these programs are that they really do is trade unemployment insurance for employment, because the focus here is really on how do you get people back. So we just wanted to kind of put these in front of you as helping you know also what we're doing on the back end to get folks back to work, even while you're struggling with what exactly should be done to support them during periods of unemployment. And these are things I think we'd like to talk about more as we move into the future and think about what a workforce system could or should provide individuals. So with that, I believe we...
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. But a special comment for Mr. Slater. Your presentations regularly depress me. However,
Thank you.
However, I want you to know I nevertheless look forward to them. I appreciate the quality of your data, the rigor of your analysis. I think they're unparalleled in this building. So thank you very much for coming in off.
Okay. And I also have a comment about that Platform to Work program, because I've got actually neighbor's iron worker who's been out of work for a long time, and who's found out that the longer he's out of work, that's a very physical job.
Yes.
And he's not a spring chicken anymore. And that is really affecting what it is. And so the idea of having the programs of dealing with the issues around unemployment when you are long-term unemployment, and it's not that you don't have the qualities and capabilities. This guy's out on the every day.
Right.
Every day looking. I think that's an aspect that I never thought of, but it really is something when you have no said to you so many times, and the mortgage is coming due, and your wife is all of a sudden very ill. You know, those are the sort of things that programs that I think are very, very good. So thank you. Any other questions, comments? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, I close the informational hearing on loss of federal emergency unemployment benefits, and I adjourn the meeting on the House Committee on Business and Labor.